I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The human genome is on its way, maybe this summer. It is the sequence of chemical molecules that could be printed in a few hundred pages of the New York Times, spelling out the microscopic code of our genes as printed in most of the cells of our bodies. But the genome of the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, is already out. It was completed in February this year, published in March. 13,601 genes have been labeled and located on the spiral staircase of fruit fly DNA. A large number of the human genes associated with problems and diseases like Alzheimer's and kidney failure have been found in fruit flies, too. Genes associated with behavior, with sociability, or punctuality, or sexual stamina will be found in common as well. Measuring their power will be another matter. Our guest, Jonathan Weiner, has written the life story of one scientist's scientist, Seymour Benzer, who's been at the center of the modern search for genetic understanding since the science was born in the mid-1930s. The 1930s, when Seymour Benzer, on his bar mitzvah in Brooklyn, got his first microscope to mark his growing up. For reasons that Jonathan Weiner will explain, fruit flies have been the guinea pigs of this genetic work. But the underlying question is an ancient one, and it's about us. Connection listeners, what part of our lives was written long ago in code on the inner fiber of our beings? And are we about to read that story in its own language? Our fruit fly connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan Weiner's book on all this, now in paperback, is called Time, Love, Memory, about one great biologist and his quest for the origins of behavior. Give him a call. Add to the buzz on fruit flies at 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Jonathan Weiner. We wanted to talk about this book for a long time. We've talked about related matters, but never so much about Drosophila, the fruit flies. Before we get to the philosophical and human questions, explain why the fruit fly.
Well, it's a humble little creature to have played such a large role in modern biology. But you can say that it started modern biology, and it started it because it's so humble, because it's such a little commonplace animal. They're not much bigger than no-see-ums. These are not the house fly. These are those very small flies, not much bigger than gnats, that you'd see flying around a bunch of bananas.
Let a pear go overripe in the kitchen,
right,
and they'll be there somehow.
There they are. And T.H. Morgan at Columbia in the early years of the 20th century had already crowded a very small laboratory with starfish and sea anemones and seaweeds and all kinds of picturesque laboratory animals. He was really kind of an outdoor lab guy, reluctantly a lab guy. He didn't have room for much more, and so he told a student, one of his undergrads, who wanted to do a almost a science fair experiment, to put a bunch of bananas out on the windowsill, trap in a jar some fruit flies, and do his experiment with those. And as a matter of historic interest, it was a behavior experiment. He wanted to see if they would change their behavior over 30 generations kept in the dark. But those were the first fruit flies that led to this extraordinary revolution in biology, and they did because they took up so little space in Morgan's lab and could be fed on the bananas.
Behavior is one thing. Who had the first notion that something in a so-called genetic structure. You quote Morgan in 1935 as saying, what are genes? But who had the first notion that there was some kind of embedded code in there that would tell you all about fruit flies and maybe then about human beings?
Well, of course, then you have to go back to Gregor Mendel, the now famous, then obscure monk Gregor Mendel in Central Europe back in the center of the 19th century, who bred pea plants and arrived at a glimmer of the idea, more than a glimmer, he really had a system for looking at it, but that there are bits of inheritance, which he called factors, they didn't use the word genes yet, factors that are passed down from one generation to the next and shape tallness or shortness or yellowness or greenness in pea plants, and maybe in everything else. And that paper's significance for the problem of heredity was rediscovered in 1900, And the idea that there are these factors, these bits of inheritance, was established in Morgan's fly room once he started playing with the fruit flies.
You write about this fly room. I wish you'd take us into it. First Morgan's,
a strange place.
And then the other fly rooms of the world today.
Well, it's too bad it's not been preserved. I went by there in the course of my research, and it's just an art supply room now at Columbia. It really should have been kept as a museum, but it would have been a rank and smelly museum. Morgan was sort of a miser in the laboratory. He was fairly well off. He was a relative of Morgan the financier. He was a Kentucky aristocrat, but in the lab, he didn't like to spend money, and so the fruit flies appealed to him partly for that reason. He used to collect empty milk bottles, he and his students would, from Manhattan stoops on the way
so
to the lab.
So they stole them?
Well, according to laboratory legend, anyway, they did, and also from the Columbia cafeteria. And they fed their flies on the milk, on the bananas, which hung from the ceiling. They also munched the bananas themselves. They threw the peels in their desk drawers. One of Morgan's students said that he never opened his desk without closing his eyes for a minute to wait for all the cockroaches in there to scuttle away out of sight. It was a grotesquely messy place, and there were flies, escaped flies, buzzing around everybody all the time. It gave people the heebie-jeebies to walk in there. And yet the science that Morgan and his students were starting was exceptionally pure and abstract. It's kind of paradoxical. Out of that mess came a science that really leaps onto an abstract plane that biology hadn't been able to reach before the discovery of the gene.
Yeah, and it's where it gets difficult for lay people like me. But by the time Seymour Benzer gets into it, he knows he's looking for genes. He also is manipulating mutations in the fruit flies he has to elaborate the question. How did that work? How did he get there?
Well, it was a really egalitarian place, the fly room. Morgan gave a lot of room to his students, his favorite students, to maneuver. And one of them, Alfred Sturtevant, who was only a senior at Columbia at the time, I guess he was 18, 19, took home hundreds of breeding records, thousands of breeding records that they had accumulated in the lab, looking at different mutations, and put them together and had this extraordinary insight that allowed them to show that genes really do exist, which was still controversial then, that they're located on those chromosomes that are bundled up in the nucleus, in the center of every living cell, and that they could be mapped. But I think I've gotten ahead of myself. You were asking how it started, and it really started with the first mutant, which was a white-eyed fly. These little fruit flies have red eyes mostly, and Morgan, who was watching for a mutant as part of that high school student science fair style project, discovered one white-eyed fly in one of those stolen milk bottles. And he was so attached to that white-eyed fly, because it was the first window into these bits of inheritance, that he used to take the bottle home with him and keep it on his night table while he was sleeping. His wife was in the hospital having a child. When he went in to see her and see the baby, her first question was, "How is the white-eyed fly?"
How long did he have to watch it? I mean, these are short-term beings, right?
That's right. But he wanted it to breed during its short lifetime, and it apparently was a little bit poorly. It was a little bit feeble. But it did manage to breed and pass on its genes, and he watched the passage of that white eye through generations of flies. That allowed him to replicate and extend the monk Gregor Mendel's work with the pea plants, and also to show that those patterns of dominant and recessive and all of the rest of the beginnings of genetics to begin to lay down those foundations.
But along comes Seymour Benzer, and the title of your book is not just poetry. When you say time, love, memory, he was constructing very complicated experiments including behavior and genetic selection, to make connections. He found the clock gene in the fruit fly that told him an awful lot about time. He also found a lot about love through mating experiments and memory through shock experiments. Add that sort of construction onto the fly room.
Yeah, it's a huge step, and yet in one way it was a very simple step. What Benzer decided to do was where Morgan and his crew had looked for mutants with different eye color or wrinkled wings or a stumpy thorax, visible mutations. Mm. Benzer decided to look for flies that had mutant behavior, aberrant behavior, and then to try to trace the genes connected with that rather than with, say, white eyes, and map those genes to the chromosomes. So it would be a first nuts and bolts.
How did he presume to know the fly well enough to say what kind of behavior was mutant? It's hard enough in human beings.
Yeah, it's you have to watch a lot of flies, and you have to get to know them pretty well. You have to love your system, is what a biologist would say. You have to really get to know these flies. But, of course, by the time Benzer got into the picture in the middle of the 20th century, actually in the early 1960s, he turned to this problem. There was a vast literature about flies, and he had just gone to Caltech for a year in Pasadena and happened to be down the hall from Morgan's old fly room, and Morgan's golden boy, Sturtevant, was still alive and still coming around. Ed Lewis, Sturtevant's golden boy, was there. Many of these people had received or would receive Nobel Prizes, and so he got good coaching. And he got the flies, he got the fly bottles, he got Ed Lewis's best technician. Everybody wanted to help him because he was one of the glamour boys of the new molecular biology.
Walk us through, if you can, the discovery of the clock gene in the fruit fly, and then we'll try to think of some of its implications. How did he figure out the wake up mechanism in the fruit fly?
Well, that was his first great breakthrough, and I say in the book that it was as if he and his students had managed to take the back off a watch and look at the clockwork inside for the first time, the clockwork of instinct looking back down at the level of the genes. And you have to know about Benzer that he was drawn to frontier subjects that seemed completely flaky and implausible when he got into them. He had started out as a physicist during World War II. He did work that led to the discovery of the transistor, secret project during the war, paralleling the Manhattan Project. And then immediately, as electronics exploded, he got tired of it because it was crowded. And he went into what's now known as molecular biology, and with Watson and Crick and a few other revolutionaries. Started the science, the modern science of the gene, at the level of the molecules. He made the first fine map of the fine structure of the gene, which is now unfolding in the genome projects that you were talking about earlier. The Human Genome Project probably will get published just this year. So Benzer had a role in starting all of that, mm-hmm. and now when he turned to fly behavior, he had that glamour attached to him, and so he was able to get good students to look at problems that seemed completely out to lunch, completely implausible. And this idea, to look for the sense of time in a fly and try to find a gene connected with the sense of time in a fruit fly, it seemed totally absurd. I mean, it sounds absurd even now. And yet they did.
Rather looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, literally. How did he do it?
Well, he got a very gifted young student named Ron Konopka to spend the summer, I think it was the summer of 68, watching flies
to
wake
hear
up in the
everything
morning.
happened, right?
Everything was happening outside that fly room, and poor Ron was sitting in a fly room watching flies wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night, because they do that. Even if you watch them by infrared light, which they can't see, you see that even in pitch darkness, even if they've never seen a ray of light, they will still live on a roughly 24-hour cycle, and they'll do that for generations, which means that somehow they've got a clock ticking away inside them, and it's in the genes. So what Kanopka did, following Benzer's strategy, based on Morgan's before them, was to look for flies that didn't get up at the right time in the morning, or that didn't emerge from their pupal cases, didn't eclose in the jargon at the right time when they were coming out into the world in the first place. They tend to do that at dawn. They tend to wake up at dawn. Drosophila means literally lover of dew. They need dew in order not to dry out in the sun. They like drinks of dewdrops. And so they are timed to come out at dawn. And Kanopka looked for strains of flies that did not. And he found insomniac flies that had no sense of time at all, got up, went to sleep, got up, went to sleep, pathetic arrhythmic flies. Mm. He found other flies that had an eccentric long rhythm, several hours longer than the 24, other flies with a short rhythm, several hours shorter than 24-hour rhythm, so that, you know, if you were...
Slugabed, sleepyhead flies. This is amazing.
Some of them, yeah.
So then you assume, or he assumes, a genetic mutation here or variation. Then what does he do?
Well, then he breeds those flies, just the way T.H. Morgan had bred the white-eyed fly. He breeds his insomniacs, and he sees whether their kids are insomniacs. And in fact, in the 200th strain he looked at, he found a fly with an eccentric clock, and it passed its eccentricities down generation after generation, and they mapped that gene to the fly's X chromosome, and it turned out to be right next to, poetically nice coincidence, it was right next to the white gene, which had started the whole revolution in genetics.
Forgive me, how did he find the gene?
Well, it's a
13,000 genes to choose from. Which one controls the clock?
You have to do crosses and crosses and crosses and see which traits tend to get passed down along with that, the trait you're interested in. For instance, this period gene, as Kanopka and Benzer called it, is right near the white gene, as I said.
Yep.
So if you have a white-eyed fly that's also an insomniac, it's likely to pass both those traits on to its kids and their kids and their kids, because the genes are so close together that they're not going to get separated in that random shuffle that genes go through with each generation as sperm meets egg. So you have an indicator there that the period gene is near the white gene. It's really very, very subtle, in some ways simple, in some ways very tricky little experiment that Sturtevant invented back in Morgan's lab, involving the crossing of flies and then looking at those traits and how they're passed down, whether they're linked or not, suggests whether the genes are linked together on the same chromosome. And then little mathematical tricks that Sturtevant worked out allows you to tell how far apart the genes are on that linear array of the chromosome. I describe that experiment in the book in detail because I think it's one of the great eurekas in the history of science, and it should be better known. Sturtevant's big night. He should have been doing his homework. He pulled an all-nighter instead, and he figured that out at the age of 19.
And then the net result, or the eventual down-the-road result, is that at the end of March this year, Science Magazine publishes a whole issue on the Drosophila genome with a huge fold-out, color-coded sequence in many layers and beautiful colors of all the chemicals that make up this fly on the DNA spiral. It's rather remarkable. What I want to go to phones, but in a word, where does this take us on the human questions here of genes and behavior? And then we'll go to phones.
Well, it's a huge question, but in a word, Darwin was right. I mean, when you look at this map, at these sequences of genes, and you're trained in this area of biology, you say, my God, how much of this is in human beings? It's something like two-thirds of all the genes known to cause human diseases, for instance, are also in the fly. Huge, well over half of the genes in the fly are also in human beings, many of them doing very similar work in human beings. So what we're talking about, for instance, with the sense of time, the genes that shape the sense of time and that circadian 24-hour rhythm for the fly, were invented so far back in the evolution of life, so near the trunk, before the branchings of the tree, that we all have it too. So we have the same gene, that period gene, ticking away inside every one of our cells, along with now two dozen other genes are known that work together to make that clock, and it's very similar to the clock in the fly. So as all of the letters of the genetic code in human beings, 3 billion letters, are written out like this map we have in front of us right here of the fly's genes, it's going to be like a Rosetta Stone. The genes in the fly are going to allow us to read and understand the significance of those 3 billion letters in our own cells.
Jonathan Wiener is our guest. His book on the genome of the fruit fly and the 50-some year decoding of it is called Time, Love, Memory. It's now out in paperback. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about genes and then ultimately their connection with human behavior, human destiny. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Bruce is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Bruce. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a question. About 30 years ago when I was in high school, somebody did a paper, and it was kind of a class joke about homosexual fruit flies. And I was wondering if there had been any recent more scholarly research in that area.
What was your theory about it in high school, Bruce?
Well, I was a little... I really didn't know that much about homosexuality, so to me it was kind of like, the typical high school kid thing. Oh yeah, homosexual fruit flies, and it was kind of a giggle. But being kind of ignorant about it, I didn't really know what to think, except for the general,
Bruce, it's a fair question, and you'd be surprised what scientists know about the sex life of fruit flies. Love is a big part of this story. What do you know about love, homosexual or otherwise, among fruit flies?
Well, a surprising amount. I called the book Time, Love, Memory because Benzer and his crew have found constellations of genes connected with the sense of time, with love, and with memory in flies. And then these genes, they have connections with our own experience. Love in flies, I could be calling it sex. It could be time, sex, memory, but let's call it love. You see an amazing instinctive reaction when you put an ordinary male fly in a petri dish with a female fly, even if neither has ever seen a living thing in its life, even if generations have been raised in isolation in a fly room. These two creatures see each other and they experience what Benzer calls an aha reaction. And the male extends its wing and makes it tremble in a sort of love song, then extends its other wing, and they go through Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, dance routines, and it's all instinctive. It's all in the genes, and Benzer and his students have mapped that. Well, there's one mutation, and this might be the one that your friend was writing about in high school. There's a mutant called Fruitless. This fruit fly, Fruitless, when a fruitless male sees another male in the fly bottle, it seems to experience that same aha reaction. And it extends the wing and dances around it, an ordinary, non-fruitless male will bat it away, literally give it a brush off with its wing. But if you have a whole bottle full of fruitless males, they form sort of conga lines in the fly bottle, and they start dancing around the walls of the bottle. And if they're happy, quote unquote, if the food is good, the temperature is right, from dawn till dusk, they'll dance around the walls of the fly bottle. And I've seen it. It's an amazing sight. And there, some here and there, there's one extending a wing, kind of like a tambourine, and waving it in the air. That's all from one mutation.
I was going to say, what do genes have to do with that?
Yeah, it was created in a lab at Yale by a scientist named Kolberg Gill, who afterward dropped out of sight and was last seen working in India. But he bequeathed to science this mutant fruitless. And he created it by zapping flies with X-rays, which is a standard way to create typos, basically, in their DNA, mutations. And fruitless, the mutation is caused by one small piece flipping out of the chromosome, out of the strand of DNA, and getting reinserted, flipped. So it's an inversion, literally, a physical inversion of a piece of DNA. And that's what causes all of that aberrant behavior.
I want to come back to these typos and the commonness of mutations among the fruit flies. Know the fruit fly and you might know everything about genetics, even human behavior, with Jonathan Weiner. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. We'll be right back. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, the fruit fly or Drosophila connection with Jonathan Weiner, whose intellectual biography in a certain way of the scientist Seymour Benzer is called Time, Love, Memory. It's about the search for all of those functions, in a way, in the genetic structure of a fruit fly, who shares a rather amazingly large number of genes with us. Here's just a fragment of the book. He writes, "A single Drosophila is not much bigger than an asterisk. It is so small that an escapee from a fly bottle," and the flies are always escaping, always in orbit around the four corners of every fly room, "does not even buzz unless it flies into a Drosophilist's ear. They seem silent without a microphone, and they look like nothing without a microscope. But even in Seymour Benzer's first nights among his first half-pint milk bottles, he felt that fruit flies might turn out to be a magic well." And indeed they do. The whole fruit fly genome has been mapped. The human genome will be mapped within the next few months. Make the genetic connection at 1-800-423-8255. You've talked about the experiments that located the clock gene and learned a lot about love mechanisms. What about memory?
That was an extraordinary breakthrough that Benzer accomplished with a student of his named Chip Quinn back in the early 70s. And first, before they could study memory using their flies, they had to show that flies could learn. So they spent years trying to teach flies simple lessons. And 4 years, they couldn't get flies to learn a thing. See, if they couldn't get flies to exhibit the behavior of learning and memory, then they couldn't explore it with mutants that might learn or remember differently. So finally, they built a little teaching machine, a sort of a T-maze in which flies are presented with a dead end. They can make a left, not a dead end, a T intersection. They can make a left or a right. To the left is an odor that smells something like tennis shoes in July, and to the right is an odor that smells a little bit like licorice, at least to the human nose. And if the fly turns toward the tennis shoes, it gets a shock. If the fly turns toward the licorice, it finds its way home. After 10 repetitions of the shock, they found that the flies were beginning to be reluctant to go toward the old tennis shoes in July. And so flies could learn. And having shown that flies could learn, they could begin to screen hundreds upon hundreds of flies after zapping them with X-rays to create various random mutations in their genes and try to find flies that were mutant in that behavior. And the first one they found they called dunce, because dunce couldn't seem to learn a thing.
All right. Make the human leap here. You locate a function like memory or learning, and you locate the sort of genetic place on the DNA that seems to make it work. Then what? And when we have, I mean, what I'm really interested in is when we have the human genome, what are we going to do with it?
Well, the human leap is a simple one to make from that discovery of memory genes, call them, in the fly, because many of the genes involved in memory storage in the tiny brain of the fly are also doing the same kind of work in our much more massive brains. And in particular, there's a gene called Kreb, which has been explored by Benzer's students. And if you inject an extra Kreb gene just right into the brain of into the genes of a fly, so that it's expressed in the brain, the fly will have the fly's equivalent of a photographic memory, and it will need only one shock, one lesson instead of 10, in order to avoid for the rest of its life the smell of old tennis shoes in July. That same gene again works in us, and so in principle, this kind of research can lead toward a better understanding of memory problems. Why do our memories begin to deteriorate as we age, for instance? It can lead, again, in principle, to the ability, using the same tools and virtually, in some cases, the same genes, the ability to, should we wish to, engineer human embryos in the petri dish and give them better abilities to learn and remember. So it opens up directly a real nuts and bolts mechanical ability to do what, for instance, the Nazis hoped to do during the Holocaust, to shape human evolution. They did it in the most ghastly, evil, blundering way one can imagine. Now it becomes possible to do human re-engineering. Perhaps somewhere within our lifetimes or within this new century, it will be possible to do the sorts of things that they dreamed of, or Darwin's cousin Francis Galton dreamed of when he coined the term eugenics after reading The Origin of Species.
1-800-423-8255 makes the genome, the fruit fly genome connection with all manner of human implications. 1-800-423-TALK. Carmenza is on the line.
Yes, I have a question back on the previous caller question on homosexuality. And this is a question on how do you keep the lines of the fruitless flies if they have this presumed homosexual behavior and no interest in mating with the females?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a little bit like breeding seedless grapes. You have to have some flies that carry that mutation recessively, pass it on, but don't express it, so that the genes will get passed on from generation to generation, but only in some flies are they expressed as that homosexual behavior, the fruitless behavior we were talking about. And I should add that although there are remarkable links between the genes that Benzer's exploring in the fly and genes that are connected with human behavior, clearly there's a case in which we're talking about something vastly more rich and complicated in human beings than in these little fruitless flies. Nobody's suggesting that it's that kind of difference could be traced to a single gene.
Carmenza, do you want to follow it up?
No, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The fruit fly genome connection with Jonathan Weiner. His book is called Time, Love, Memory. AJ is on the line.
Hi, good morning. Interesting
morning.
Show. I'm sorry I didn't catch all of it. But I just had a response to what the gentleman just said regarding the Nazi allusion about the comments about manipulation. And I'm not sure if you discussed this earlier, but it sounds like, you know, there's a distinction needs to be made between positive and negative eugenics. And also, I'm concerned about modification of the germline, where that is for preventing diseases, to enhancement, which I think you sort of alluded to. And I think, isn't that a sort of a slippery slope to be getting involved in? Because what then becomes disease becomes enhancement, and then you have a world of people who look alike, think alike, act alike, and that's some, there's some serious ethical concerns there.
I couldn't agree more. I think it really is a slippery slope, and it's going to be very hard for us to find our way on it in the next years, because the science is moving so fast that most of us really haven't caught up with it, and we don't realize just how much is becoming possible. I was struck in the course of my research by an experiment that was done at NIH, the National Institutes of Health. They were using that white gene, the white mutant that opened up the science of genetics in the first fly room, as a marker in doing some other more arcane studies. And they discovered that by genetically engineering flies that had an extra gene and that white gene as a marker, so that when the flies emerged, they would know it had the gene of interest because it also had white eyes. Those white-eyed flies began chasing, the males began chasing each other around in the fly bottles. They behaved like the fruitless males. And the scientists were baffled because they thought they were, all they had added was that white gene. They eliminated the other one. They just added the white gene. And again, they got that behavior. So we're talking about extremely rich and strange terrain, even in the fruit fly. And I often say that in spite of one century of genetic engineering with these flies, nobody has made a better fly yet. And so there's grounds for this field is fascinating, but it is also hazard-ridden, as you say, and it's going to be more of both in the next year.
AJ, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the genome connection. Reed is on the road between Richmond and Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes, hi.
Hello,
how are
Reed.
You?
Good.
Yeah, I had a quick question. I work in the dental industry where I'm exposed to x-rays quite often, and I was curious to know that using an x-ray to change a fly's genetic makeup, if that can be done to humans. I'm not a scholar on eugenics at all. I just had a question.
Yeah, well, I hope you're using all the precautions that they told you to use when they sold you the x-ray equipment.
Yes, I do. And I was just curious, though, does that multiple, depending on the, I guess, the KVP or the load of the x-ray, does that do anything like that to humans?
Oh, yeah, it's dangerous. You have to be careful. That's the reason that you put the lead aprons on your patients, and you know you're careful not to take too many x-rays of the kids in your practice, because those x-rays can cause mutations in any living cell. If it flips the DNA in there and that gets passed on when the cell divides, that can be the start of a cancer. And if it changes the DNA in the sex cells, in sperm or eggs, then that can be the start of a birth defect or a mutation that will get passed on. So it's something you've got to be very careful about. That all came out of, again, out of Morgan's fly room originally. Another one of his students, Herman Muller, was the one who managed to zap DNA with X-rays and make mutations, and he got the Nobel Prize for that discovery.
Reed, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Carl is on the line.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Great show. I'm kind of surprised the way the author uses, you know, these words like clock, letters, map, memory, you know, metaphorically. And this is, you know, the one comment. The second is, you know, Darwin was really wrong in the assumption that there was a gradual kind of evolution, you know, over the span of these billions of years. You know, there were these huge, huge interruptions, you know, that we know now that ran havoc on this planet. So I would like to hear from the, you know, from the author what he has to say about this, because this is just, you know, in the last 10 years this came out, and I'm surprised that this is not really taken up much more, because it is so unreal, you know, what happens to this planet, and we are exposed to this. Yeah, I would like to take the answer from the other.
Carl, thank you.
Well, two questions. First, I didn't follow your first question completely, but you were surprised that I talk about time, love, and memory, or clocks, or letters of genetic code metaphorically. It's a fairly natural thing to do, I think, to use metaphors like that. I think we're staying pretty close to home there when we talk about the sense of time in the fly as a clock ticking in the cells. It really is a biological clock ticking in there, and you can see how all of the gears intermesh now in these wonderful dissection experiments that are going on in the lab.
But people wouldn't say from any of this that Darwin was wrong, would they?
No, they wouldn't. That's your second question. But just about the metaphor, one more thing, that I did mean there to be kind of a... that there should be two ways to read that title, Time, Love, Memory. On the one hand, it sounds almost as metaphorical and elusive as the title of a book of poems. On the other hand, it means literally three constellations of genes that are linked to behavior, pieces of DNA. And I think there is something weird about that for us, that you can now look at the domain that we thought of as private experience, approachable only through poetry and the arts, and now we can approach it through DNA. Now, Darwin was clearly right about evolution by natural selection, and I assume you're not questioning that. What you're saying is that sometimes the change isn't gradual, sometimes it's abrupt. And that's a fascinating fact in the historical record that doesn't contradict Darwin, but enriches our understanding of our own history. It's certainly true. I mean, if you look at these flies, you can see that evolution has had to be quite gradual over the millions of years these flies have been buzzing around on the planet, because different species of flies that have split off on their twig of the branch still are very, very close cousins. The DNA is still very much alike, one species to the next. And then you look at the DNA that we carry and the DNA the flies carry, and now we're talking about enormous spans of evolutionary history, and yet our DNA is still quite close. So the changes that take place in those abrupt periods don't destroy the fundamental likenesses of living things on the planet, and evolution keeps ticking one letter at a time.
Darwin was not wrong, you say, but there's a fascinating moment in the book where E.O. Wilson implies, it's a little obscure, that Freud was wrong. E.O. Wilson, the Harvard ant biologist who tried to make some of the first connections of genes and behavior and paid a price for it, said to you, I take it, in an interview, he admired Benzer's work with qualifications, but he said, better Benzer than Freud. Quote me, better Benzer than Freud. Just what did he mean by that?
I loved that.
I did too.
Yeah, he was encouraging me. He's a wonderful encourager of people in biology and people who write about biology as I do. And he was telling me I had chosen a good subject here. I think he was speaking a little bit metaphorically, better Benzer than Freud, but also he meant it literally, that this is the place to look for the foundations of human nature. If you build up from the genes, you're going to arrive at a really solid understanding that you might not get if you kind of approach the problem from outside, as he felt that Freud did, and invent structures that are more metaphysical than physical,
and also nurtural or malnurtural than more than natural.
Right. We have a couple of different sort of folk proverbs that talk about the difference here. I mean, there's, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree. That would be Freud. The kinks and bends come in your early childhood. And then the other is, the apple didn't roll far from the tree. And that would be Benzer saying that much of what we are is set there in the first seeds.
You also have a great line in the book from the patron saint of the connection, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, the ancient precept, know thyself, and the modern precept, study nature, become at last one maxim.
Isn't that beautiful?
It's fantastic. He anticipated so much. 1-800-423-8255. Chris is on the line.
Hi. I'm wondering if this type of science, kind of like the Skinner type of science, makes too big of an assumption. There's kind of a dangerous leap where they say genetics determines human behavior. What about will and consciousness? For example, I can change my sleeping patterns by will. I can decide that I'm going to sleep in a certain way, and just by making a decision. Fruit flies can't do that.
You're right, and it's a very important point. It's where we get with our memories, right? We have so much more talent for memory than the fly does, so much more memory storage capacity, that we can really think over our lives, and we can look at our choices in ways that flies in that tea maze can't. And we can push against our clocks quite effectively, but you know, you do feel the clock pushing back. I mean, if you fly from the East Coast to the West Coast, you're forcing a jump, and you feel it in the jet lag. That's your clock ticking away in those cells, and it takes a while for you to force the hands of the clock forward or back. We have much more freedom than the flies do, there's no question. But we also have some of the same basic instinctual equipment. And this is just a first way in. I'm not saying that that human nature, that we have any sort of overview of this subject with ourselves. I'm saying only that here with Benzer's work with these little flies, we have a first glimpse of the connections that underlie our behavior at the level of the genes. It's just a first glimpse.
We have a first glimpse in Science Magazine of the, in the fruit fly case, of the human genome. How many billion characters did you say there will be on those 23 chromosomes?
There are 3 billion letters, apparently, in the human genome. Three billion.
3 billion letters.
As opposed to only 180 million in the fly. So we have roughly 30 times as many genes as the fly does.
We're getting ready, I mean, just for the reading of this book, it may take 50, it may take 1,000 years to figure it all out. You speak of it as a Rosetta Stone. Give us a preview in 30 seconds.
In 30 seconds, I'll tell you, Benzer, we haven't talked about Benzer's behavior, which is marvelously rich and eccentric. Among other things, he's a clock mutant. He can't get up in the morning. He works all through the night. People are now looking at his DNA to find the mutation in human beings that produces that clock mutant.
Mm. Jonathan Weiner, keep reading, keep writing. You tell wonderful, wonderful stories, and it does begin to sound like the story of our time. Time, love, memory, about one scientist, Seymour Benzer, and to search for the origins of behavior. If you're anywhere near Boston tonight, Jonathan Weiner will be reading from his book and signing it at the Harvard Coop at 7 p.m. this Thursday, May 4th. Jonathan Weiner, thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by NetLibrary, a provider of e-books, now offering the public affairs e-book release of First Person, the self-portrait of Russia's new president, Vladimir Putin, on the web.